Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. So what I'm going to talk about today is just kind of the status of where we are with LIGO, what we've analyzed, what we're going to analyze, and then where we're headed next. So hopefully just give you a summary of all of those things. Okay, so if you'd asked us a little over a year ago where we'd placed our bets on the first detection, we probably would have pointed you to the rates paper that we kept updated, depending on new population synthesis models or new observations, and we would have said binary neutron stars would have been the first detection. If you looked in that paper, you would have seen that the low detection to high detection, or realistic detection rates per year range from somewhere between 4 per 100 year to 40 per year. And we had pretty good ideas that those numbers were sensible. We had observed the Hulse-Taylor binary. We'd observed the double pulsar. So that's where we would have placed our bets. Neutron star black hole binaries and black hole binaries also had considerably good chance of being detected, but they were a bit more uncertain. We had not seen those in nature, but we knew from population synthesis that they could be high. So,
come from before any detection?
0.4 for neutron star binary? Oh, I guess just population synthesis. Yeah, those numbers were very uncertain. So you can imagine our surprise when we woke up early, actually a year ago yesterday, so it was the anniversary or the birthday of the first detection of gravitational waves yesterday, so I've got some celebratory pictures on there. So this happened very early in the morning for us, so we woke up to a bunch of emails from the Europeans saying there's something interesting in the code, or in the from the search that analyzes the data in low latency. So within 3 minutes of arriving, actually, we knew that there was something interesting. And this one was hard to ignore. Even though we weren't officially in the first observing run yet, we were still in the engineering run. When we looked at the raw strain data, well, this is actually filtered just a little bit to remove some known noise sources. It stands out very obviously, signal to noise ratio of 24. And when you compare that with the best match waveform from numerical relativity and subtract the two, you're left with residuals that are fairly consistent with noise. And so we also all looked at these time frequency spectrograms that were all trained to look for the chirp signal, so increasing frequency and amplitude with time. We looked at these time frequency spectrograms and said, this is a textbook example of a chirp waveform. So we didn't believe it at first, but over time, we determined that this was a binary black hole system over 1 billion light years away, and it radiated 3 solar masses of gravitational wave energy in about 0.2 seconds. It's very, very energetic. All right, then on December 26th, just as everybody was at home spending the vacation with their family, we had another alert, this time within 70 seconds of arriving. Something looked very interesting in the data. However, if you look at the raw data, you can't see it standing out as much in the raw data. So this signal took match filtering to really pull the signal out. And so you accumulate SNR over time, and you can locate the peak using the best match template in time. And if you look in the time frequency spectrograms as well, it's not as obvious. But the match filter technique was able to pull this out for us. And it was another binary black hole merger, about 1 billion light years away as well. And this one radiated about 1 solar mass in about 1 second or so. It's quite a bit longer than the first. All right, and meanwhile, we were arguing over the existence of a possible third detection that had actually arrived earlier than this in October. We call this the second Monday event because it also arrived on a Monday, much like the first. It had about a 2% chance of being due to noise, but it was extremely coherent and it had very similar parameters in both of the detectors. And for all investigations looking for mapping of noise to the signal, we could find nothing. But if you do look here, you see that, for instance, there is this band of low-frequency noise in L1. At the same time, there's this chirp structure. So people did a lot of investigation of that and found that it's basically just low-frequency noise at Livingston, probably due to waves hitting the land and causing it to rumble. There's no evidence of upconversion of that low-frequency noise into the higher-frequency band where this chirp is occurring. And there's no way that low-frequency noise could be causing a chirp-like structure as well. So that's why we're pretty confident it's not due. Yeah, seismic due to ocean motion.
Can I ask you this?
Sure.
How long is the ring down time of this detection? Is that very short compared to others?
The ring down for all of these signals is very short. I'll show you some plots later.
This
but
one is the longest.
I think just a bit longer. I'm not sure of the exact time, but I'll show some waveform plots so you can get an idea of that in a few slides. Okay, so those were the three detections. So a natural question to ask is, okay, we're seeing all these binary black hole mergers. What about a stochastic background of gravitational waves from these binary black holes? So if you calculate the energy spectral density from a binary black hole population, you find that it goes to, as a chirp mass to the 5/3 and then a frequency to the 2/3. So you can plot those for different assumptions about the population. And then also LIGO sensitivity here, future sensitivity. So it's listed as O5. So that's several years down the road. And how those populations might pop out with an F to the 2/3 relationship for frequencies below 100 hertz or so. So there is some chance of finding that. You can look at it a different way. Instead, if you want to say, okay, what would the SNR of such a population be given a certain amount of observing time? So we accumulate this SNR as we observe longer. You see that the expected line here is in blue, and then there's some uncertainty on that. So if we look at the best case scenario, I don't know if you can see, but there's this pink line here. In about a year and a half or two years, we could start detecting this background with a 1 to 3 SNR, so 1 to 3 sigma detection. Worst case scenario, I guess would be the bottom of this pink line here. We would never see it with the current planned advanced detectors. So we'd have to have some next generation of ground-based detectors to see it. But it is possible that we could find this stochastic background before the design sensitivity is reached. Yes?
Is that SNR or probability of
signal-to-noise ratio? Yeah. So we would accumulate some signal from this background that would show up as a bump, basically, in the noise curve. And that would be distinct from the resolved sources that we would also be detecting. So these would be unresolved binary black hole background, basically. OK. So let me talk a little bit about what I work on, which is the search to find these and the search that determines how significant these signals were. Okay, so I work on the GST-LAO pipeline. And probably a lot of you know Chad Hanna, who was a postdoc here a few years ago, and possibly also Kip Cannon, who was faculty at CETA. They were the developers of this pipeline. It uses GStreamer, which is an open source media streaming library, and LAL, which is the LIGO algorithm library, to basically perform compact binary coalescence match filter searches in low latency. So basically, instead of streaming media, we're streaming gravitational wave data. And you can see the latency here. So after the data streams in green is the GST-LAO pipeline, can do a full match filter search in about 60 seconds or so after the data is arriving. There is another low latency pipeline, MBTA, multiband template analysis, I think. And they're a bit quicker, but they're not a full match filter search, and they're not covering the full space that we cover. Okay, so some of the highlights from L1 for this particular search. For the first time, we implemented this Uber bank. So that's what's shown here. Previously, we searched for binary neutron stars, neutron star black holes, and black hole binaries separately. But right before the start of L1, we decided to combine all those searches into one. So this is the template bank here, shown mass 1, mass 2. And it's colored by different regions. So this would be like the binary neutron star regime, neutron star black hole, and black hole binary regime. And those different objects are allowed to have different spins. So the neutron stars are only allowed to have spin, dimensionless spins up to 0.05. And black holes are allowed to span the range from 0 to 0.9895. So quite a large template bank. Every point on there is a waveform that has to be generated and used for match filtering.
So I have one question. So this is the main template bank that is used for anything that has to do with match filtering in LIGO, or does GST LAR has something on top of it to reduce the cost?
We do something, but this is the main bank that actually all of the searches used and then had to confirm that their pipelines independently detected this. So this was like the universal template bank for everybody looking for these types of signals. And I'll mention in the next slide how GST-LAO handles that for low latency, to make it possible in low latency.
So just out of curiosity, so you said, well, they identify the boxing day signal within 7 seconds of having gone through the whole LIGO band, right?
Yes, of having arrived.
I want to say, I want to play a different game, you know where I'm going. So if I want to say at what point can I say, if I only shoot for SNR effect, which you've got more in this one. Mm-hmm. How much shorter would it have been than
If we only wanted to detect part of the signal by using shorter templates?
It's in our page, it's like, okay, there is something.
Oh, how much better could we do here?
How much shorter can you?
I'd say we could probably get down to 20 seconds or so, yeah. Yeah, so there's about 200,000 templates or so here. Actually, a lot more than that, almost 300,000. So yeah, if you only are only looking at short signals, it turns out you can reduce the number of templates you need by quite a bit. And so that reduces the number of match filter operations that you have to do. Okay, so let me just actually jump to that, because GST-LAO does have to use some tricks to make this work. So they use time domain filtering. Previously, time domain filtering was thought to be too expensive, so everything was done in the frequency domain. But by using template bank compression with singular value decomposition, so decomposing the templates into their basis waveforms, and then also multi-banding so that you do different sampling rates at different frequency bands, you can beat down the costs enough to make it competitive with frequency domain match filtering. And so the SNR, which I'm going to call rho in the other slides, I just want to point that out. Sorry. Sorry, why did we do time?
You asked and you told at the person that we used the frequency domain.
Yes, the other match filtering pipeline uses frequency domain filtering because the order of operations there needed for match filter is n log n. But here with the time domain, I think it goes as n squared maybe, or I can't remember exactly. It's the number of operations needed here is more, and so you have to use tricks in order to make it work. But you have streaming data in the time domain, so you need to use time domain filtering. Okay, one other trick we use is this autocorrelation-based test, which is basically a signal consistency test. And here's the ingredients for it. Basically, you need a measured time series, SNR time series, shown in black, and then you compute this predicted SNR time series from the template autocorrelation with itself, and you subtract the two. And that gives you a residual number that you can use to also rank your candidates. So we call that xi squared. And a low value of xi squared would be good. It would mean that the template matched well with the observed signal in the data. OK, so those are the two quantities, the SNR, which is this rho, and this xi squared. And those go into making this likelihood ratio ranking statistic. So here, we're building up a noise model. So we're using non-coincident triggers. So these are things that are not found in coincidence between the two detectors. We're not using time shifts. Lots of LIGO searches talk about using time shifts. GSTL doesn't do that. They're using non-coincident single triggers. And then they also build up a signal model. Basically, it's semi-analytic. It's assumed uniform in volume. It's pretty non-sensitive to the type of signal. So you need those two things for a likelihood ratio. OK, so here's what a noise model might look like for some combination of rho and xi squared for noise and for signal. So you can see they look fundamentally different. And I should say, remember, this is composed of the non-coincident trigger. So this is from actual data. This is semi-analytic. And so basically, the ratio, the likelihood ratio is going to take the ratio of these two probability density functions. The color map here is giving you an idea of the probability of these parameters given noise and the probability of these parameters given signal. But it's actually the log of that. So the black regions, very low log, log probability. OK, so you take the.
Are we hypothesized that
the H and L?
Yeah.
So, OK, so we measure these for each interferometer. And so X is just some generic parameters that could be SNR, could be that xi squared, or some combination of those for each detector. And then you also have, for the signal, you also measure the detector sensitivity or horizon distance at that time. So all those things go into making the probability of all these things given a template and signal. And then you divide that by the noise piece, so all of these parameters for Hanford, given that template, given noise. And then same for Livingston, given that template, given noise. So basically, to think of it in a simple case, you're taking the ratio of these two histograms for just those parameters. As I said, there's other parameters that go into it. OK, but it's also for each template family, too. So here's a movie showing how the noise histograms or noise PDFs evolve as you move from low mass templates to high mass templates. So high mass templates have a different sort of noise model than low mass templates, and we have to track that. So every frame here is templates that have been grouped together that are similar. You notice as we get to the last frames, the variability in the noise increases, and the noise is more prevalent in the whole space. So that's why it's important to keep these noise distributions separate, measured separate for different template families.
So, sorry, can you explain why would the noise be dependent on the mass? And the noise is the noise in the detector?
That's right.
So why would you say the noise?
Well, the noise is the noise in our search. It's the triggers that have been picked up by a particular template. And so low mass templates, you get the in spiral merger ring down. High mass, you're going to get merger ring down. Those tend to look more like bursts of noise in the data. So those templates pick up more background. The low mass templates, it's hard to find some noise source that looks like an in spiral merger ring down. So low mass actually has a well behaved background.
Can you also show in the distribution of your template, that it's a lot coarser for higher masses. Is that also part of the reason why the noise is higher?
No, but it is So the metric the metric of the template bank determines that spacing. And so up in the high mass regions, you don't need as many templates to fully cover that space with the required mismatch. But actually, if you add more templates up there, you will get more noise because more templates will be ringing off that space. Yeah, it's a little tricky. Let's see. So we just have to measure these noise distributions for different groupings of templates that have similar noise backgrounds. Okay, so where do the events fall in these two models? So we've got them shown as red, blue, and green crosses here in the noise model. And this model here has two color bars. The warm color bar is the color bar that we saw before, basically showing the likelihood or the log of the probability that these particular events are being noise or being signal. So you can see they fall very nicely in the signal regime. This other color bar here is when you leave coincident triggers in your noise model. Seems like kind of a crazy thing to do, but you can imagine here that this red cross, if we didn't have that blue there, it would just fall in the black region where there would be basically nothing. It would have very, very low probability of being noise. So in order to estimate anything that makes sense, we have to leave these signals and the coincident triggers in their background. And so that gives us some data to work with in order to rank them. And so it's kind of putting a bound on their likelihood of being noise. It's not a very rigorous thing, but it does give us a bound.
Sorry, I'm mentioning two color schemes. You have two color schemes of
the factor. Yeah, OK. So this warm model here is the noise background, the likelihood of being, the log of the probability of being noise given those xi and rho parameters. And that is measured, the warm is measured from our single non-coincident triggers. Now you can also leave all of the coincident triggers in your background and model your noise with that as well. And when you do that, you gain these additional cooler color map pieces. So everything from the cooler color map that had matched with the warm color map has been masked out of this plot. And all you're seeing is what was left when you leave all of your coincidence in your noise model, which seems like a crazy thing to do, but is the only way that we can put a number on the likelihood of this thing being noise.
If I understand correctly, so I'm not understanding this. So the red cross would be more probable as noise if you keep track of coincidences?
Right. So it's saying that if we use a noise model that includes GW150914 in that noise model, so including a signal in the noise model, then.
But why would you do that?
Exactly. Well, we had to do that in order to bound it, because otherwise you get 10 to the minus 30.
But that's a signal. And you're saying that was signal, I'm going to assume or imagine it's part of my noise.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's exactly what I want to understand. Why it's happening?
We needed to place a bound on it, and if you don't have anything other than your interpolation of this black region, which is just basically a power law fall off of the measure of the log probability here, so it's 10 to the minus 30 probability.
No, I understand the learning is, but why isn't that important? A signal. Us. I'm rolling for the numbers.
So this is trying to match what is done with the time shifts. So for time shifts, we include the signals. They're called little little signals, and you match a signal with a glitch and get some estimate of the probability. Since GST-LAL doesn't do time shifts, this was our best attempt at doing something that they do. And we agree with you that it doesn't quite make sense to do it this way.
So I'm just trying to understand what the pitfall could be. I could be adding something that now I'm going to call it noise. So if you got an R event that is exactly the one which you use, then you would say, oh, this is noise.
Right.
So if I got two signals that are exactly the same, separated by some time, but then the first one you say, okay, I'm going to make it part of my noise.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have a second signal that looks exactly the same as the first one. What do I do with it? Will it now call it noise? Or will it realize, oh, no, this is signal?
It's just, you lose your ability to call this a true noise model anymore. The interpretation is that you're estimating its log probability of being in this new model, which includes all the signals as well. So I'm going to show another plot that is maybe more intuitive, but I just wanted to lead up to these plots, which are the plots that made it into the paper. So in order to understand how we got these bounds on the background for the searches. So what you see is basically a count of the number of events per log likelihood bin. And so that's shown in orange for each of these. And then you have two models of the background in each case. The background in black is including all search results or all coincidences, all signal in the noise model. The purple in this case is exclude the signals, or exclude the triggers from GW150914 in that model. So you can see it falls off much faster. If you were to try to estimate the significance with that, it would meet somewhere down here as opposed to some slower fall off. Now, if we want to look at 151226, independently of 150914, we remove 150914 because it was a signal. And then estimate the background in the same sort of way for the two different cases. LVT 151012 shows up here, just slightly above the background. So all we can say for 150914 is that it was greater than 5 sigma. So we had to put these plots in order to match with the plots that were using time shifts. So I just wanted to explain that, but what might be more intuitive is this type of plot, which basically shows the noise model that we had seen originally. So none of that nonsense of leaving in signals in the model. So that's what falls off here. And then a signal plus noise model, which matches very nicely with the three events that we saw, except maybe 150914 is a little bit louder than expected. And so from this, we can then say the probability of astrophysical origin for both 150914 and 151226 is 1 to about 1 in 10 to the 6th or so. So pretty much 1. And then LVT has an 86% chance of being astrophysical origin. So all the other remaining events have less than 15%. So that's why we. So the stuff that starts popping out here as we move back down the plot. So there may have been another signal in there, but we couldn't say anything better than 15%. Okay, so that's the end of the binary black hole search for O1. That's, we found two, possibly three interesting candidates.
Can you kind of ask one more question about that last comment you made? It could have been another signal, but you wouldn't say it's better than 15%. Right, but some people are interpreting real, and just to go on the deeper, but people have done that and identified something that may have had 10% chance of being real or something?
No, we haven't. Well, I mean, people have looked at the next tens of signals, but what it would require, so at some point you stop being able to see by eye the chirp structure. I mean, by LVT 151012, we couldn't see the chirp structure by eye. So we have to rely on the match filter
right.
to tell us if there's something there. Yeah, so it's difficult. You'd have to do a really in-depth analysis of the data around a given time, and to track down that time, you kind of have to know there's something there. So it's difficult.
People have not done that, or have they done it and can say, no, there's nothing?
No. The one thing we can do is say, okay, for GRB triggers, we can take those times and dig in deeper. So I'll mention that a little bit, but that's the only case where we've done that.
Uh-huh. That blue line and error function?
That is the noise model that we showed in the previous plot.
Yeah. Well, it should give the error function.
Oh, error bars on there? Yeah. I agree.
I'm asking why it is like the dime, not curve.
It falls off as a power law, I think, and that's basically due to the extrapolation of that black region on the curve.
Maybe it is the second power of the log of n, something like that.
Oh, right. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, we're just extrapolating there what it should do, but basically there's no chance of the noise that we see in the detector producing signals at that high of log likelihood. I mean, you can think of a more sophisticated model, perhaps. Okay, let's move on. So what can we infer about these signals? Okay, so here's maybe going part of the way towards addressing your question about the ring down. All right, so what we've got here is the amplitude spectral density curves for the O1 detectors, and then the three signals. And so this is in spiral, coming into band, merger, and then ring down for each of them. And they're scaled so that the relative amplitudes give you an idea of the SNRs of the signal. And here also we see the signals in the time domain. So for GW150914, it was quite loud, came in with quite high amplitude. It was relatively short. We see just the last few cycles of in spiral and then the merger ring down. LVT151012 was quieter, but falls somewhere in between the two other louder signals as far as number of cycles. And then 151226, we get, I think, can't remember the exact number, but for I think the last second or so, we see 55 cycles of the in spiral. And I think the merger ring down is just out of our measurability. But it's still within the data. So those are the visual representations of the signals that we saw. And I like this because you kind of see that we've got a nice variety. Okay, so measuring the different parameters, the component masses, from Bayesian stochastic sampling. We measure all the parameters using Bayesian stochastic sampling. Now, from the early in spiral, you can measure the chirp mass. Actually, I put the formula up here because you can measure it just by measuring the frequency and the frequency derivative. So it's a very well, it's actually our best measured parameter, in particular for 15, 12, 26, where we have quite a bit of in spiral. You can also measure the mass ratio from one of the PN coefficients. And then from the late in spiral, you get the total mass. So you combine those three measured parameters to pull out the component masses. And so we see that here. 150914 was our heaviest merger, 3629. LVT in between there, 2313. And 151226 was the lightest merger that we measured, 14 and 7.5. And you can see that the degeneracy kind of follows these lines of constant chirp mass. So that's why we see that structure there. Okay, so measuring the final black hole parameters, we get this from the late in spiral and merger measurements. And we can also measure the radiated energy as well by subtracting the M total measured from late in spiral and then M final measured from the merger ring down. So we find that the final black holes had masses of 62, 35, and 20. And that resulted in GW150914 radiating 3 solar masses in that 0.2 seconds. So you can see why it was so energetic. LVT radiated 1.5 solar masses, and 151226 radiated 1 solar mass in about 1 second or so. The final black hole dimensionless spin nicely hovers around what we expect, 0.7 for roughly equal mass black holes. This was the number that was expected for the final spin of the black hole. Okay, let's see what else. More binary parameters. So we can also start looking at the some aspects of the spins of the components. So we define this parameter called chi effective, which is basically a mass weighting of the spin components that are aligned with the orbital angular momentum. So what aspect of them, or what magnitude of them, is aligned or anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum. And we find that for the first two cases, they hover about 0. So no support for spins that large parallel aligned or anti-aligned spins. It's not true for 151226, where we do measure a significant non-zero chi-effective parameter. So combined with some other measurements for 151226, we can make the statement that at least one component of 151226 has a spin magnitude greater than 0.2, a 99% confidence level.
Is that what you guys study? Even the error bar?
Yeah, this is combined with a few other measurements as well. This statement is combined. It's not directly from this statement. So we're talking about the magnitude of the component, one component spin. And the mass ratio now, you can see it's not well constrained at all. It kind of spreads this full range. Although for 150914, we can say maybe that it's closer to one. It's larger than the other two, so more equal mass.
So can you say a bit more about the other, what really comes into this 99%?
Yeah, let me move to this plot, these plots. All right, so here we're looking at different aspects of the spin. So we've got the magnitude of each of the component spins. I don't know if you can see, but the plot on the left would be the first component spin and then the second component spin for each of the three signals. And it's unfortunate, you can't quite see the resolution here, but for 151226, we're getting a good measurement that there's some spin on this particular component. So this is a radial plot showing the magnitude and then the angle that is measured with respect to the orbital angular momentum vector. So the takeaway, I don't know if you can see, but the takeaway is we can't see.
So there was no spin precession in the boxing data, right? So spin measurement has to come through the chirp, which was the other quantity you told us about on the previous slides. I mean, we did insert in how to reconcile these things.
Reconcile which two things?
Well, so how do you measure spin if there's no spin precession?
Of the final black hole.
Is that the spin of the final black hole?
These are component black holes.
Right, the previous four number was 0.2.
For the individual.
Well, for one of the components.
For one of them, but that came with huge error bars. So, and that is a measurement of which spin?
We don't know. All we can say is that one of the components had a...
But it's not the final black hole spin.
It's a component spin, yeah.
Okay, so how do you measure that if there's no precession? If there's no precession of the orbit?
Well, in most cases we can't, which is why you're not seeing much variation in these. But it is from the in-spiral. Yeah, I mean, it's a very small effect in the in-spiral measurement.
Well, the way it sweeps up deeper in frequency. So it's an, you have to have some net component of angular momentum aligned with the orbital angular momentum, so to not have very at the slightly earlier frequency.
So you still measure frequency and add like that thought.
Right, so from there, if you go all the way to very close merger, without speed, you merge, at which of which you begin to turn around is at the lower frequency. So that's one way of saying it. You have to have some contribution of the speed.
But
the only can say anything about the one along the orbit, but they don't, cannot say anything about the,
right,
the projection on the plane.
You can also get it from the final spin.
Yeah,
but because you have the masses and the final spin.
But
been.
She got to, they didn't get a clean signal of the merger.
Okay.
Of the ring.
Right. Sorry, what's your question?
It's just the same thing. I was asking if any of this information came from the ring down to getting the final spin. And you'd say must have had these initial spins to get that final spin.
Oh, well, yeah, it comes from an independent measure of the merger ring down. For the case of 15, 12, 26, I think they could measure it fairly well, but yeah, I'm not sure exactly.
One of the ones, but it's higher than the others. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm not sure the relationship between, if there is a relationship between this spin measurement and these component spin measurements. My understanding was that these measurements came from the Inspiral piece. And for 15, 12, 26, we had the best measurement of the Inspiral. Therefore, that is why we have some evidence for spin on one of the components with high confidence. The others are kind of blurred out. There's no support that leans one way or the other. You can't say there was or wasn't. Basically, it's uninformative, is the point of these plots. Yeah. Sorry, I don't know if that answered fully your concern, but I can say one thing though. We can measure the spin of the larger mass component because it contributes more to the Inspiral. So you can't see the resolution on these, but there's a bit more support in particular regions for the larger of the two black holes in each case. Okay, well, let's move on from that. Distance parameters, so measuring the luminosity distance, it scales inversely with the amplitude of the signal. For 1509-14 and 1512-26, both about 420 megaparsecs was the measurement, but 1512-26 was quieter. It's just that the signal was spread over a larger time, so we accumulated significant signal there. LVT we didn't measure quite as well. It was quieter, but it was more massive than 15, 12, 26. Therefore, it must have been at a further distance, and that's why the posterior here peaks at about 1,000 megaparsecs or so.
Sarah, I just realized this. So both the two signals you have, one had a SNR of 24, the other one has an SNR of 13 or something,
mm-hmm.
11.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the error, the luminosity distance is about the same. So there's very little dependence on SNR, on the error.
That's right, yeah. 1509-14 was so darn loud, and 1512-26 was much longer and better measured. So those two effects, I guess, kind of weigh each other out.
So it's just kind of a ballpark.
Yes, this is very.
This is as good as it's going to get with respect to distance.
For now, okay. Yeah. We would require, I think, a counterpart here to start constraining better. Okay, sky localization is mostly determined by the time difference between arrival at the two sites. And so, again, you can't quite see here. Oh, darn. Well, we can focus on this plot. So geographic coordinates. So you can imagine a signal that arrives at both detectors at the same time. Let's come from directly overhead between the two of them. So in order for that to be equidistant. It's basically a ring on the sky between the two detectors. And so that's actually the case for LVT 151012 and 151226, where the timing between is relatively small. You see that the sky localization passes between the two detectors, so H and L here. And then also in the antipodal region, which I can't see, but it also would pass here as well. And then 150914 was loud and actually favored the larger time delay, so did not fall on the region between the two detectors. We expect most detections between the two detectors on the ring on the sky, because that's where we're most sensitive. So it's not surprising that the two detections occurred there.
Excuse me, what if they are different? For example, because the distance between two are the same, and the speed up, you know, the speed up light.
No, but then you can have the signal coming from there or the signal coming from there.
Yeah, it's basically a triangulation of the direction of the source, the timing. But we know that the maximum would be 10 milliseconds, which is if they came, hit one, and then went the maximum distance to the other. Okay, and then just the sky area, LVT 151012, not resolved very well at all, 1600 square degrees. Hundreds of square degrees is basically the story for most of advanced LIGO until Virgo comes online. Okay, so what are the implications of these signals? How am I doing on time? I'm running out. Okay, so let's see. All right, so let's go back to our merger rates. Now we've got some detections. So if we convert the numbers on the first slide to rates per gigaparsec per cube per year, it would have been, the previous estimate was about 0.1 to 300. So slightly different units here. Now if we say, okay, what if the population of binary black holes is composed of 150914, LVT 151012, and 151226 like signals, then those numbers get constrained between 14 and 154 per gigaparsec cube per year. If we then extrapolate to overall rates, and this is the number we're now quoting, that number broadens, the range broadens a little bit from 9 to 240 per gigaparsec cube per year.
The rates that you're going to detect, or the rates that, like, or is it the number of events that actually happen?
Yeah, that's an astrophysical rate. So let's talk about detection rate. So that's what this plot's trying to show. So we've got the probability that the number detected is greater than 2, greater than 10, or greater than 40, given some accumulated volume times time over the volume times time that we've accumulated already in O1. So here's O2 about to start. So the probability that we'd see two signals is almost 80%. The probability of 10 signals by the end of O2 is also about 80% or so. So between 2 and 10, we should see an O2. Okay. So summary of these black hole masses. So the previous known black hole masses came from X-ray studies, and they were a bit smaller than what we've seen. But the lowest mass ones that we detected are consistent with the X-ray measured black hole masses. And in fact, the lowest measured one here we know has to be greater than 5.6 solar masses. I forget the confidence on that. It's maybe 90% or more. So this is above the hypothesized mass gap. So it's consistent with its existence or uninformative about its existence. And it's definitely above the maximum neutron star mass. So that's why we say it's a binary black hole. The most massive are actually above the highest measured mass from X-ray studies. So these are the most massive stellar mass black holes that have been measured to date. Okay, so we can also attempt to constrain the binary black hole merger rate, or sorry, the merger mass distribution. We can model it as a general power law, which is maybe not a great thing to do, but its initial start makes sense based on previous models of mass laws as power laws. And so we want to constrain alpha, the power. So some assumptions that went into this, again, which probably aren't great assumptions, but the minimum mass here is 5, which does make sense based on the maximum mass of a neutron star, minimum mass of a black hole. But the model is highly dependent on that, so that's important. M1 plus M2, less than 100 solar masses, flattened mass ratio, and redshift independent mass distributions, which again is probably not a great assumption. But in any event, this is the posterior that we get. We find that it's peaked, the alpha value is peaked at about 2.5, which is consistent with the value that we actually used for the rates calculation in the previous slide, which is the normal 2.35 value for the IMF-like power laws. 2.5, not surprising, based on the fact that our mass, the volume times time does go like the mass to the minus 2/5. So that's probably where this number is coming from.
Sarah, there's a curiosity. Has anyone done the exercise of changing V to 1?
Nope. We have not. So you can imagine also that maybe we want to model some breaks in this power law as we get more detections too. So there's lots of stuff that needs to be done here. Very, very weak constraint placed right now.
So what's the reasoning behind the denominator from 1 minus M min? So that would mean that most of them are actually very close to the min.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know.
I guess you can, if the other one, well, I'm not sure which model comes behind it, but if the other one would say that whatever supernova went off, really black hole, if you're going to make larger mass, then you want to retain as much mass as possible. So then perhaps it's natural to say be closer to the minimum. But that's a strong assumption.
It's pretty dramatically close to the minimum.
Second?
I mean, that diverges at the minimum.
So. Yeah. But I think it's, in this context of the new formation channels, people are beginning to dispute this. Well,
yeah, definitely more work needs to be done here. Okay, so one other thing that we can definitely say is that these black holes, progenitor stars, most likely formed at low metallicity in order for the black holes to be so massive. This is for 1509-14 in particular, but may also be true for the other black holes. And that's because stars at lower metallicities exhibit weaker winds, reduce mass loss, and allow the formation of such massive black holes. So here are two possible formation pathways. And I know there's actually a lot of work out now exploring the different formation pathways, but I just picked these two. Basically, the formation is consistent with either isolated stellar environment formation for massive stars and like a galactic field, or dynamical star formation like in a dense stellar cluster. And so in the isolated stellar environment case, you basically have two very massive progenitor stars that go through different stages of evolution. You have a common envelope stage and direct collapse to black hole. This happens over mega years or so. In the dynamical formation case, you have lots of exchange interactions happening. All kinds of different partners are swapped, and eventually you end up with a binary that gets ejected from the cluster. And I think the timescales there, at least for this case, were listed as giga years. So, but actually, all of our black holes are consistent with either of these two cases. So what can we say? Binary black holes exist. We didn't know that before, we hadn't observed that before. Merging binary black holes exist in a broad mass range, so from a 14-7 system to a 36-29 system. Now we have also evidence for stellar mass black holes with mass above 20 solar masses or so. I guess I skipped my second point there. It wasn't important. And that's the first time we've measured such massive black holes. Again, it's consistent with either isolated binary or dynamical formation formed in low metallicity environments, although 15-12-26 and LVT 15-10-12 could have formed from lower mass progenitors or in higher metallicity environments. OK, so I have quite a few more slides, but I feel like I've ran out of time.
Summarize.
OK. So tests of general relativity, perfectly consistent. Nothing has been measured so far. This is a joint posterior from both 15-09-14 and 15-12-26 for the in-spiral deviations in the in-spiral coefficient, coefficients, and then intermediate coefficients, and then merger ring down coefficients. And they're all basically centered about zero with a really tight constraint here at the 1.5 PN. Sorry, that wasn't a good background. Let's see. Binary neutron star and neutron star black hole merger rates. If it wasn't obvious already, we didn't detect them because of the template bank we're using. We would have made an announcement about that. So we've just set upper limits on those. And we're not quite, so the upper limits are shown in blue for binary neutron star black hole. We're not quite probing the model predictions yet. We've started maybe just a little bit probing those and may be able to start constraining these models in O2. So stay tuned for that. OK, intermediate mass black hole binaries. Some of you mentioned to me yesterday these should be highly detectable, and indeed that's the case. For 400, 500 solar mass maximum aligned spin, we're talking lots of gigaparsecs here. So these things we're very sensitive to. Here's the template bank. It's shown in red. So this is the Uber bank. This would be the extension of the bank into the IMBH mass range. And so that work is ongoing. Burst searches are ongoing as well, looking for all sorts of different things, sensitive to different things, maybe find something unexpected. And I should give a shout out to the coherent wave burst pipeline, which was the pipeline that found the first signal within 3 minutes of running online. So it was actually a burst search which found the first binary black hole signal. Here's the one case where we could dig deeper into the data and find sub-threshold candidates. So we trigger on GRBs reported by the gamma ray coordinates network, and there were 76 reported, plus about an additional 20 from the IPN. So they're going to do further follow-up on those as well. Constraints on spinning neutron stars. The amount of spin down due to gravitational wave emission. These were the upper limit set for the S6 run. This is the prediction of where we will be for the proposed advanced LIGO sensitivity once we get to the final sensitivity. So there are quite a few spin down limits that we will beat at that time. Be able
so
to place them.
Has the same exercise analysis been done for the O1 or not yet?
Has not been done yet. Right. Yep. So we're waiting to get results on that. It's ongoing. Here's the run schedule. So I'll just say that we hope to start running in the next few weeks. That is up in the air, though, as we wait to see what happens with understanding the noise sources in the detector. And also people coming back from the floods in Louisiana. Venting just means that, yeah, the vacuum's been opened. Oh, it could mean that too. Okay, and some of you yesterday asked about the improvement that we'll see, and I gave you a way too large of a number. What we're actually expecting when O2 comes online is moving from this blue to orange curve, so about a 15 to 25% improvement in sensitivity that comes mainly from the increase in laser power from 20 to 50 watts. There will be no gains in the low frequency noise, unfortunately. And this is the 8 LIGO.
Actually, it's going to be slightly more powerful than the old one.
That's right, yeah. So that's an improvement in the BNS range from 75 to 90 megaparsecs. So we do gain a bit there. OK, I'll stop now. That's everything.
So that purple curve is the ultimate goal?
For the current.
And when do you expect to get there?
I think we're hoping 2018, roughly.
Do you expect to get there?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, I mean, lately I've been getting more excited for the things you haven't seen than for the things you have seen.
Yeah, right.
It's exciting for me. So, but now, I mean, one puzzle is this fact that the speeds that you're getting is slow. Right? And this is going back to the discussion we had a few minutes ago with Eric. Once you increase the speed, then the binary grows deeper in frequency, the signal gets higher, and therefore your SNR will be also higher. So has anyone done the exercise of how would have been the SNR, based on these two or three signals that you have, bumping up the effective speed along the orbit under direction, what would have been the effective horizon, and then saying something that the fact that you haven't seen with three signals or with two signals very little that you can do? But just maybe work for what's coming. Because it is passing that of the two signals that you've seen, it has low speed, and the fact that you've even seen further out, mm-hmm. and you're also rolling out systems that have higher speed, slightly further out.
Right.
And so it looks very weird. But statistics of small numbers and a bunch of
things. Might be premature for
it.
Might be premature to draw conclusions.
Right, but I mean, the exercise, in the meantime, you don't have to.
Yeah, I think that it would
be. Yeah, I'm not sure anyone's done that that calculation yet, but I know people say that what we've seen so far is still consistent with the rates that.
Yeah,
we predict. Yeah.
It's also consistent with what you're not seeing these very high masses, but that plot that you quickly went through because it's a paper, probably it's not out yet or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
You're saying that's something like 270 gigaparsecs. We're not seeing these kinds of things. So you say, well, so many gigaparsecs beyond seeing systems that have very high speeds or lower masses.
Yeah, I'm not sure that anyone's done that yet.
So I have two questions. One is for the intermediate maps, like I said, you might hope to see for the ultimate or free. It seems that like 6-7 gigaparsecs is your range that you can see out to.
Mm-hmm.
But if I assume that the luminosity distance estimates are going to have the same error bars, it seems that you're sensitive to sources at cosmological distances,
yes.
But you're lacking the accuracy to actually be sensitive to things like the cosmological parameters. Is that correct?
Oh,
because you have to, at some point, at some distance, you have to, these things start to matter, right?
They definitely do for IMBH, and that's been a big discussion about how to handle that. So I know they're working on that, but I don't know, about the cosmological.
The other question was about the evolutionary history. So the taking the low spin values at face value, and maybe I'm too naive on this, but I was thinking I can cook up some ideas why the stellar evolution environment produces highly spinning black holes. You have something that rotates, collapses, or you have accretion dwarfs or anything, right?
Right.
So that's certainly doable to make them really spin very fast. I think in the global cluster environment, kind of I'm struggling a little more to come up with examples. So my question is, you said, and LIGO announced that they cannot tell these two scenarios apart. So I must be missing something. Is there some other?
Not yet, because of the number of spin.
Yeah, well, the main issue is that we don't measure the spin parameters very well at all. I mean, we can say the one statement we can make is that one of the components of GW151226 had a magnitude greater than 0.2. But you're right. The spins are what allow us to constrain the formation, in particular the orientation of the spins as well. If they form together, they should be aligned. If they, So the hope is that we'll be able to measure those better for the next run.
Can you show the timeline again for?
Okay.
The one that you requested in
The caveat here is just that this is as of like today, so it's very preliminary, and they just want people to understand that it could change in the next week or so. We could push back. So this is optimistic that we start the observing run at the end of September.
So the vacuum period is going to re-drew the vacuums to reseal
the vacuums. Uh-huh.
Okay, so that's 2 months.
Well, we've been down since was it February? Can't remember.
So is the diagram saying that you can still operate while you're venting, or
No. So we will turn on. We will seal the vents and. The engineering run will start, which is basically lockdown for, it's basically collecting data, but everything's still kind of in testing mode. So we will have good sensitivity when the engineering run starts. The engineering run leads into the observing run. It's like a soft start.
And we're all taking a break.
Yeah, we decided no more Christmas Boxing Day events.
Unfortunately, it's in order for the need to prevent if something you guys have to open, the detectors will be open and something will be changed. So what's changed? The way and O2B or the detectors will be open?
Between A and B? I don't know the details, but I suspect it has something to do with tracking down the noise source at low frequencies that they haven't figured out yet. So in order to start O2A, I think they're not going to be able to answer that question. So they want some later time to address that again.
So it sounds like you're turning the laser power off in O2A and you're expecting to find some problems that you then have to fix inside.
Yeah, I think there's been testing of the laser power already, but yeah. Anytime you add a new piece or turn a knob, new noise sources appear.
The point of what happens in between, is it more or less understood that July is the end date of the O2? Okay.
Yeah, that hasn't changed, but I don't know if it's set in stone, but that's the one number that's been kind of constant.
Or more than whatever may have been noticing.
Yeah, right.
Okay. What are the expectations of the duty cycle? Like, how much better?
Oh, it should be better. Yes, I think we were below 50% for O1. They're hoping above that for O2, which is one of the reasons that. So we may not gain as much volume, but we will have more time, perhaps.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah.